This is Mark Haslam from Southeast Whitetail, and you're listening to the Son of a Blitz podcast. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Son of a Blitch podcast. I am your host, George Blitch, and today I got to sit down with Mark Haslam. You guys might know him from hosting Southeast Whitetail, the podcast, or even his website, southeastwhitetail.com, where he shares all sorts of articles, tips and tricks, quality deer management information, conservational efforts. He is just a man of great knowledge, loves to share. It's no wonder he was also named the Deer Manager of the Year from QDMA in 2020. That is now the National Deer Association. It used to be Quality Deer Management Association. They formed a Deer Alliance to be the NDA. So he has been doing a lot of work with his local chapters out there, running a lot of information sessions on his own property that he manages. He's got 1,900 acres that he's running. He talks a lot about just the deer management, also the turkey, the quail, all the different management systems in place for that habitat, for the wildlife out there. We had a great conversation. We ventured into talking about, the new podcast that he's hosting. It's not a new podcast, but for him being the host of the Southern Way Hunting Podcast, he's kind of just now taken over at the end of January, running those shows on his own. He co-hosted a few of them as the interim guest, or the interim host. And now he's running that on his own. Some wonderful, wonderful conversations, great guests coming up. And he's got a really, that Southern heritage and hunting culture is very rich. And he's, I think, at the epicenter of it and he's got a finger on the pulse of it. So he's the one to really be able to talk about that more. And there's always something you can learn, no matter where you're coming from. When you have someone that has been this involved and knowledgeable, you're going to learn something. So you don't have to be from the South. Tune into this and learn something you can take back to your own property, your own public land, your own lease, whatever it may be. There's something for everyone here in this conversation, and I think you guys are going to greatly enjoy it. So without further ado, here is the podcast with Mark Haslam. Enjoy. Hey, Mark, how you doing today, man?
Good, George. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Oh, I'm really excited. So listen, you've got all sorts of great stuff going on. I definitely want to kind of walk through what you have. You know, you got a new podcast that you just took over, the helm of, and obviously you've had your own before. So there's so many things I want to talk about. And I think the best place to start is kind of at the beginning. So why don't you kind of walk us back to where you grew up, how you got involved in your, outdoor lifestyle and your love of the outdoors, and we'll kind of, jump along your timeline from there.
Sure. Yeah, I'll try to keep this as concise as I possibly can. I'm from Savannah, Georgia. That's where I still live, but I have always hunted in South Carolina my entire life. Savannah's right on the, as you would imagine, the Savannah River, the state border. And South Carolina, we've just, my family had just, really loved hunting there for quite some time. I grew up in a hunting club, and with my father and some of his friends organized, basically had some traditional timber leases, and was able to form a little hunting club. And we were in that up until about 2005, early 2000s. And that's when we bought the family farm in 2006. Also in South Carolina, a little bit further in, about 2 hours inland. And that's really where I probably cut my teeth on hunting, management, and, furthering my, outdoor love.
So what kind of size property was like that? Because, I've run a 300, I've run 1,000, and there's a lot. I mean, anytime you're in the double digits, you got work. You get into the triples, it's a whole nother story. So I was just kind of curious what kind of, listeners, what are you managing as far as the property there? Can you describe it a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, it's two tracks that are a couple miles apart, and they total 1,900 acres. There's a good mixture of agricultural fields that we lease out to a farmer. He will typically rotate crops of cotton, peanuts, and corn. Soybeans in our region of South Carolina, you don't see as much. You see some, but beans just get hit so hard before they're harvested that a lot of times it just doesn't make sense depending on that immediate site. So we do have some different land. We're in the Midlands region of South Carolina, so we're just above the coastal plain. We're starting to get a little slightly rolling hills, not much, but we are thankful to have a swamp and some creek systems, which helps out in some of the diversity.
Sure. And you guys just kind of are wrapping up your whitetail season. And mm-hmm. I think I had heard you talk about the number of like y'all are at like 78 you had to take. Now there's a certain number that, you know, you're getting. And I know in Texas, we work with our wild game biologists. They're local. We're sending a bunch of data throughout the, you know, August, September months to be able to figure out what we have, what ratio we're looking for. So I kind of wanted to talk about, you know, as far as how you and your state are getting that recommendation, that data, what are you sending in? How are you getting a certain number? And what is your goal and your ratio on your particular property there?
Well, our data and our target goals are really coming in-house. They're coming from us.
Okay.
You know, South Carolina has a very liberal whitetail season. And pretty much my entire life, I mean, it's been baiting's been legal, you know, corn, feeders, and it's the longest deer season in North America.
Yeah.
So it's very long, and somehow we're still able to kill large numbers of deer. So with that being said, we obviously have a big population. You know, we were looking at our numbers this week, and a lot of times when you look at it, when you're trying to search for deer populations or deer densities in the South, when you're looking online, even state by state, a lot of times you don't really find much information. You know, you'll see a typical average of, they'll say like 20 to 40 deer per square mile, mm-hmm. which might seem like a lot to some people, might not seem like a whole lot. Of course, it's all subjective. It all depends. We have been averaging the past couple years around 27 harvests per square mile. So we're killing anywhere on average about 27 deer per square mile, whereas a lot of the, you know, South Carolina, what they're saying, a lot of the larger densities are 40 per square mile. So right there, you know, there's something grossly off. But what you can find is a lot of universities, especially in the South. There's so many different universities. Texas A&M, out where you are, mm-hmm. does a phenomenal job. But they do those universities have a lot of extension centers, and they have a lot of they do a lot of deer density studies. You know, looking at depredation on crops or whatever. And those places I have found have a phenomenal resource. They publish a lot. It doesn't really hit the mainstream hunting media outlets, but if you just Google it or search these universities, you can find it. Clemson, they've got a great wildlife program, and their population densities match up pretty closely to our numbers, which they're saying that we're on average of our part of the county about 170 deer per square mile. So, and of course that's going to fluctuate a little bit.
Sure.
But this past season, like I said, we're still average about 27 harvests per square mile. Our fawn recruitment increased a little bit. It went up slightly. And our doe, our average deer seen on the stand, you know, not killed, but right. our average seen on the stand, hunter observations went up, as well as average doe seen, and our buck to doe ratio went up slightly from about 2.5 does to 1 buck to about 3 does to 1 buck. So right there, it's like, you know, we're not winning the battle on doe management. We're kind of almost breaking even, but we're not quite breaking even just yet. So I've been wondering, George, past year or two, because I've always been a big proponent as far as management, as far as bedding, thickets, and cover. Of course, you got to have everything else, but I like to control and have more bedding. I'm kind of wondering now we're at a point where maybe we have a little bit too much because we can't grow soybean. I mean, we had, you know, it was almost, it wasn't embarrassing, but I'm glad I had seclusion cages because this past August, we hosted the NDA Deer Steward 2 course. And so it's kind of a showcase. I mean, you know, they're host, we're the host, but they're putting it on, they're teaching it.
Yeah.
So, but we're kind of showcasing our property, and I planted about 15 acres of soybeans in one kind of general area over several fields all tight together, and the deer just blew it up. And thankfully, I had seclusion cages, because if I didn't have seclusion cages, they would have all thought that I just didn't plant it right. I planted the seed too deep, not deep enough, too late, too early, it was too wet. But with the seclusion cages, you got to see the height, you know, 4 or 5 feet tall beans the deer couldn't get, but everything they wiped out. So I say all that to say that, you know, this next year, we really need to ramp up our doe numbers. And, you know, I mentioned earlier about having a long season. It's like, what more can we do? You know, we're hunting, we're shooting does early and often. That's why I'm thinking maybe outside the box, do we need to alter our land management? Maybe we have too many thickets. And sometimes, yeah, you can't have too many deer. You have too many deer, then that will start, it will eventually start to hurt your quail and turkey population.
Sure, sure.
Just eating at a house and home. So it's like, on one hand, you've got a healthy herd because you've got doe fawns that are getting pregnant at 6 months old, which is a good sign. But if we have this many deer, that can't be good. It's a lot to unpack at times.
So when you have, you know, you got this property here, you're there in 06 and you're running everything. Was that something that you already had a lot of this information kind of being able to unfold, or was this like a whole discovery process for you? And I mean, I know as years go on, you're going to discover more, you're going to learn more, especially with one particular piece of property. But walk me through, like, what was your knowledge coming into that and then being able to kind of hit the ground running and be able to develop, you know, a quality management system? And then we'll kind of run into, you know, a little bit more work and what, you know, eventually you became the Quality Deer Manager of the Year in 2020. So walk me through those years of being able to kind of build up that educational principle and foundation to be able to then showcase this off and, hey, this is what I've learned and practiced over the years.
Sure. Yeah. It's my family's knowledge as far as land management and everything you just said was very little in 06. So we were coming out of being in a hunting club in Low Country, South Carolina, since I was in kindergarten until I was out of college. And so, you know, if you're in a hunting club, you get to do a lot of things, but there's a lot of things you can't do. These were timber leases. So these were, well, yeah, some of them were, there were many tracts that were owned by timber companies. So they're not doing it as much anymore, but they would buy land, you know, grow trees on it, eventually sell it when it makes sense, buy something else. Well, if you're on a hunting lease, you probably can't manipulate the land. You can, you know, do food plots where there's openings, but you probably can't create openings. And where there's openings in the South might not be that much. So we couldn't really do much. We weren't burning. We weren't doing any kind of TSI work. It was really just food plots and feeders. And, you know, that time I was cutting my teeth on deer sign and that type of stuff, but we weren't building the knowledge of where the deer were really coming from and all that intel. So when we eventually moved on to acquire the farm in 06, it was a very slow process, just kind of starting out, putting stands up, and then over time, learning the property and then bettering our management. But what we did have was a QDM background. And in our hunting club with my father and some of his friends, Billy Chisholm being one of them, Billy was connected with Joe Hamilton, mm-hmm. which is that time. This was, that club started late 80s, right around 90. So QDMA was firing up and Joe Hamilton was just beating the streets meeting with hunt club owners or hunt club presidents and hunt clubs in general, like ours, to try to get that movement going. So we were very much a QDMA hunt club, you know, and that was the content I was consuming, their materials, and not so much. I never really got into the hunting TV shows, you know, the sit on the food plot, shoot the buck at the very end, and that grip and grin. So we did have that background. We just weren't implementing that stuff. And then over time, we started to do that on our farm. And when it really changed was our first forestry practice we did, our first forestry cut, clear cutting some, thinning some, planting some trees, and then that really started to open our eyes as far as land management.
And what about that was eye-opening for you guys?
Well, what was eye-opening was probably just forestry practices for wildlife, because coming up, and I'm not saying no one covers this, but at least I wasn't learning this growing up from you know, other hunters, and I wasn't seeing this in marketing materials, is in pine trees. We're pine tree dominated, you know, all throughout most of the deep South. It's pine trees. There are some openings and of course ag fields, but pine trees. And if you have wall to wall pine trees that are all the same age class, all the same age, wall to wall on your entire property, it's going to be a certain level of hunting. But if you start to manipulate that and kind of clear cut this section and thin this section, you start to manipulate the land and you're creating more options for wildlife, food and cover naturally, as opposed to feeders and food plots. So once that started to come up, that was really eye-opening about how we can use that work as we're growing trees and trying to generate some income, but then also help our deer hunting out.
Yeah. And then, you know, I was just reading the 50th Legion by Colonel Tom Kelly and talking about like this idea of there are certain areas that were so thick with that canopy that, you know, the sunlight's not getting through to the ground. And whenever you're clearing out some of those things, the magical effect of that is that you're seeing a lot more forbs, you're seeing a lot of things, and now you have maybe some more bedding areas, some kind of intermediary brushes growing and things too. And I think, you know, we're talking about two different areas. Obviously, you know, in the South, Southeast, you know, there is a whole different style of hunting that completely is different than the West. So for a lot of people who are listening, who may be out in the West and, you know, kind of listening about what we're doing here, it is different, obviously different land and landscape, but a lot of the same principles of, you know, quality deer management can apply in different areas, of being able to have those open spots where now you can have, you know, those foraging areas. I mean, we cleared out another 30 acres not too long back on our property, and it's night and day difference, man. The bird and the herd, man. Yeah. We're seeing the deer, we're seeing the turkey come out in those areas, because now that there's things that are growing on that floor bed that before the canopy closed it off. So, you know, there's all these things that you're learning through QDMA practices. Well, and your QDMA now is Quality Deer Management Association, is now National Deer Association. But a lot of those principles of, you know, quality deer management apply, and what you can do on your property. And I was kind of curious what you may have for suggestions for people who maybe, you know, that have leases where you're like talking about too, they might not be able to manipulate the land as much. And what are some of the things that you might tell them that they need to maybe look at or research to be able to do the best for that property to have the best, you know, maybe if you can't work on the habitat, the best, you know, wildlife, you know, possible as far as population and healthy population. And there are some things you may give to those folks who are, you know, in that kind of seat, as opposed to like landowners like you and I who are, sure, you know, can manipulate freely.
I would say, George, one of the easiest practices someone can do is just implement just basic quality deer management principles. I was talked earlier about statistics, and I cover a lot of that on the stuff I post on social media, and I've kind of realized I need to start probably explaining a lot of that more, because it's not as it's not as complicated as some people think. And and these statistics are coming from two places: hunter observational logs, where you're done hunting and you write down what you see, you know, where you were sitting, you know, time, all that, and then what you saw broken down by bucks and does and fawns. Got to put fawns in there. And then you have the data from the skinning shed. And I realize everyone doesn't have a skinning shed. We didn't have one for a while, about I think 12 years ago, we finally put one in. And that's one of the best things to have. It just as a side note, for so many different reasons: socially, entertaining, uh-huh, camaraderie. And then also, you're skinning your own deer and someone's not doing it for you, and you're handling the meat yourself, which can be a lot of different bonuses as far as quality of, you know, of the meat and all that. But if you don't have one, and take your deer straight to processor, hang around for a little bit, give them a, you know, pull the jawbone before you bring it. It's very easy. Have them weigh it. If you don't have a scale, you know, they'll weigh it for you. And, you know, so you get this information and you can find out exactly what I was just talking about. What's your buck to doe ratio? What's your fawn recruitment? If your fawn recruitment is trending down or pretty low, you've got a problem that maybe you can't, if you're on a lease, maybe you can't do much, but maybe you stop shooting as many does. Or maybe, like what I mentioned earlier, maybe you need to shoot more does. There's a lot of different things they can tell you. And there's so many things, George, they can tell you about bucks. And that's the thing. Like, it's not just, you know, how many does are shooting, this and that. It's like, mm-hmm, if someone's really, it's like they just kind of want to cut the chase and they want to learn how to kill bucks. It's, I put out an article, I think in December, about doe data and, you know, late December doe kills. If someone's in a season where they can kill does, you know, if your season's still open, I should say, late the season after does are bred, when you kill that doe, and if it's been bred, there's some very easy ways that you can take statistics to figure out when she was bred. And so when she was bred, you start to, you know, compile different data points, and you start to get a pretty good baseline as far as your average does being bred. And I even put that in my article about people hunting public land. Man, if people are hunting public land, now I get it, it might take a little bit, but if you have buddies or you start to shoot a handful of does over a couple of years, you'll figure out when they were bred. And then that week before, that's when you need to be in the woods. That's when you need to be rattling. You need to be doing all these different things to kill those bucks. So, and that's something, man, all that takes, George, is just time. That and I tell you, it seems like it is easy, and it is easy, but sometimes when you're hunting, you got guests or you shoot something, it's easy to forget to write down. But just detail everything. It doesn't matter. It doesn't, you know, you can write it down. There's certainly apps. And then we have a website that we use. I think it's like a $20 or $25 membership a year. We have all these things. You can do it yourself, but you can pay a $25 membership, input it in, and it gives you all these and stats. And that alone can't help you out. Now, one last piece, like a hunting club lease type thing that you asked, Rachel, question, where what I'm about to say can get a little tricky, a little hairy sometimes, is that if you're on a private land lease that's owned on, you know, it would be private land, obviously, but if it's owned by an individual as opposed to like a timber company, that individual may be open to doing certain things to increase the value of the property. Maybe you talk to them about, hey, maybe we burn this over here, we create a little thicket over here, or maybe you allow us to start doing different things with the game management that will improve the wildlife, that will directly improve the value of your property. Where that gets hairy is you might price yourself out of the lease. If you start making too many recommendations, start killing too many big bucks and too many turkeys and this and that, they might say, hey, we need to bump you up on the lease, or other people catch wind and they bid you out of the lease. So that's one of the things it happens all the time, but people don't really talk about that, you know. So, but the QDM records, I mean, that alone, I think, is the easiest, and it doesn't cost any money. It's time. All it is just time.
No, I think that's very key. You know, any kind of things you can relate back to factual accounts, scientific data, things that you can actually build something on, not just like a hunch. Oh, I didn't see any, you know, doe this weekend when I was out there. Well, you know, did you account for the fact that, you know, the acorns were all fallen and they're over there underneath those trees? They didn't come out to this spot because of that. Like, there's so many things that are just kind of black and white on that. But I think having all the data points and be able to look back on them, and especially year to year, be able to see things. You know, when I took over this property in Central Texas, a lot of the bucks, people were shooting them at, you know, 2.5, 3.5 years old. As soon as they'd see something with horns, they got excited. They get their deer for the year and they're done. Instead of like being like, okay, let's let them grow. And then let's see what the potentials they could be at 5.5, 6.5. And it's a night and day difference. And what we're seeing as far as like you put on the hit list now compared to 10, 15 years ago, and there's a lot of different improvements. And now we've been able to kind of see those things over time and visually see that, that did work. But without starting someplace and being able to have some data points and taking the jawbones and that, it's really hard to maybe track all those kinds of, you know, records and growth of your property. You know, I kind of wanted to jump back to on, there's a certain point where you kind of launched your own Southeast Whitetail in 2020. You had kind of an article-based website, podcast, Medium platform. You had a little bit of everything. And then you started doing a lot more guest appearances on different other people's podcasts. I mean, you've also been a freelance writer with Meat Eater, with Wired to Hunt. And I just kind of wanted to talk about the genesis of then, like, you exploring that next level of you sharing that information. What inspired you to start Southeast Whitetail and, you know, kind of talk about the beginning stages of that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I started working on the idea of Southeast Whitetail during COVID. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, spring of 20. And so, I mean, I was, you know, my career is in real estate. And when the spring of 20 happened, initially, real estate just really just pumped the brakes and no one's doing anything. Now that summer, that market fired up and it just never really slowed down until maybe 22 sometimes. So anyways, I had some time like a lot of people did at home. And I was doing more and more things in my social media at that point. Instagram for me became an outlet for just showcasing what we're doing on the farm, hunting stuff. And I was doing a lot of mentored hunts with different conservation, like third party related mentor hunts where people are coming in that I don't know, that I'm doing, you know, collabing with different conservation orgs. We've always done that on our property, you know, hosted new hunters, both young and old, but they were typically friends or family, people we knew, started doing more stuff like that, being more involved with QDMA, now NDA. And so I kept that momentum going. And at the same time, being a student of QDM, I felt like there was definitely a shift in hunting media. And especially, you know, QDMA, I mean, you know, during that COVID period, they, you know, merged with National Deer Alliance and formed National Deer Association, kind of more of a broader range of deer hunting across the country. And, also me being from the South, you know, the Deep South, there's such a rich history and rich hunting culture in the South, but I've always felt like hunting content, if you really break it down, a lot of it across the board, whether it's management videos or, you know, management people or buck hunters or bow hunt, so much of it is based in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. Just content, whether it's marketing materials for new camo or articles or videos, so much about the Midwest, you know, pinch point and funnels and a lot of that just does not translate to the Deep South, doesn't translate to pine country. And I felt like there was a void in Southern, you know, land management because, you know, with the explosion of social media, which we didn't have, I mean, you know, was it 2012, 2010, social media really kind of blew up and all of a sudden everyone had in their pocket a video recorder, and they had a device, and there's all of a sudden there's free apps, you know, Instagram, YouTube, all these different outlets where people could create content. So there's a lot more content out there, but so much of it I didn't think was really just based in the South. Yep. So that's why I started with Southeast Whitetail and launched it in 2020, and wrote some articles. And then I was doing some guest spots along the way like this. People were having me on. My wife ended up buying this microphone for me just to sound a little bit better. And then a year after I launched Southeast Whitetail, I just recorded a podcast solo by myself. Same desk, just sitting down, freestyling. And I was like, you know, what the heck? I like what I had to say. Who knows? I just put it out there. And it was pretty interesting, kind of the feedback. And I just started doing it. And I enjoy it because I get to interview people. And I'm, you know, thankfully I'm going to have you on in a couple of weeks. But I get stuff out of it. And then I feel like I'm just, it's trying to create content that's specific to my region, essentially.
Well, and now you have kind of stepped up into another level too. You were tapped to, you know, take over. There's an interim duty with Southern Way Hunting Podcast. Obviously, Dan is starting that off. Why don't you kind of maybe, for those who aren't familiar with that, why don't you go ahead and kind of lay out the groundwork of what, now that you are the host, what you have planned, what the kind of formulation of the idea of the show, what you want to focus on. I know, you know, you sent me some information. You kind of got quarterly plans there too. But in a nutshell, if you were to give the few paragraph, you know, pitch to somebody about what the Southern Way is about, why don't you go ahead and do that? And then we'll kind of dive into that a little more too.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Southern Way has been around since I think 2018 on the Sportsman's Empire podcast network. And it was originally Southern Ground. Parker McDonald was the host of that really cool podcast. And he went on to do something else, another podcast, I think. I'm not really 100% sure. I don't really know Parker all that well. And Josh Raley filled in to take over. I think at that point was when they changed name to the Southern Way. And Josh was doing it for a while. He really liked doing it, but he's getting more and more busy with his work. He also has another podcast or two that he does. Mm-hmm. So it was just a lot of, he needed to step back from that. And that's when Dan Johnson, Nine Finger Chronicles, he's the bow hunter with nine fingers. Somehow he's able to do it. He and Josh thought about me and so asked me to host it. The Southern Way is really just kind of deep rooted in Southern hunting culture. And so what we're going to be talking a lot about is just hunting tips and tactics, interviewing different hunters. There'll be a lot of people that people, a lot of familiar names, and there'll be some people that, you know, listeners don't know exactly, you know, people I know or people I connect with. And, so it's going to be more focused on that. Southeast Whitetail podcast, I'll still be doing more sporadically, but that'll be more entrenched with, you know, research, biology, and land habitat management.
Gotcha. And so who are some of the guests that are coming on, you know, in this next couple quarters? I mean, I saw a list. There's quite a few names that I think people find, you know, fairly recognizable and, you know, some leaders in that industry. So why don't you go ahead and just kind of, you know, give a little teaser of what's to come in these next, you know, couple quarters.
Yeah. So I'll continue with, I've got some South Carolina hunters coming up. Last week, I had Mike Nadusky. He's a huge upland hunter. And he just recently purchased Ugly Dog Hunting Company, really cool bird gear. I will pretty much probably just stay on very much themed type of rather like seasonal type guest. About to transition into more, we'll still cover some more bird hunting, but turkeys. And turkeys are about to fire up for us. I mean, really down here in the South, I mean, people are getting kind of cagey waiting for turkey season. So we'll have some of that. As far as guests, I've got some names that are recognizable. Larry White is about to be on. I interviewed him again. Really, really outstanding wild game gourmet is his website. He's great. The other guest, until I until I record, I'm a little reluctant to say it just in case we don't, our schedules don't sync up. But, you know, I'm going to keep the Southern Way. Like I said, it's going to be familiar names people recognize. Yeah. And then it's going to be average people that just aren't on the social media radar.
Yeah.
So kind of keep it, you know, keep it going both ways.
Keeping it real. No, it's great. Yeah. It's good to have, I think, all sorts of different perspectives. And definitely, you know, folks that are in the industry and then folks that are working that, you know, might not have any spotlight on them, but they're the ones who are doing the work and can give you some kind of, you know, day-to-day data of what's happening. And they're, I guess the other thing I kind of, one of the things you were doing systematically is kind of, and I've done some of this, but I need to probably focus a little more on, is kind of the seasonality of things, like the different mm-hmm. kind of land management, turkey, quail, you know, predator, maybe, you know, control. And then you got warm season, you know, food plots and kind of kicking into the summer hunting tips and tricks. And then you got, you know, the end magnum opus is the meals that you can share with your friends and family. And so, you know, you talk about like Larry White, I've had him on as well. And what an amazing chef. And so you have something kind of highlight all the things that people can see on the property do. I kind of want to dive into turkey hunt with you and just ask you about, you know, what that looks like in your area on your land in that region. How is the turkey population doing? What are you seeing on the ground right now? And what are you looking forward to in your area, in your county, in your state? You know, how many birds you allotted and what do you normally take each year? And maybe go ahead and give us some, you know, delectable ideas of what you're going to do with it once you have it in your freezer.
Yeah. So, you know, George, turkey, wild turkeys, it's like some people have them and some people have robust populations to where they could absolutely kill more than what the state is going to allow them to. And then there's some areas that aren't that far away where they don't have that much. Just I'm talking about general areas, not specific properties,
right.
General areas. And so much of it, you know, so much of it depends on, I think, a lot of forestry practices. What most people know, but yeah, I mean, throughout Georgia and South Carolina, you see, a start very, you know, varying degree. And that's probably consistent, you know, with most of the footprint that the Eastern wild turkey has. And you know, it kind of brings about that question of, as far as wild turkey conservation, there's so much across the board that's been hitting hunting content in the past 5-8 years about turkey conservation, different research projects. But as far as management, I mean, it's tough because these states they're managing over an entire state that's just a boundary that someone created a long time ago. And, you know, at least in South Carolina, there used to be like 14 different game zones, I think, or 20 different game zones. Well, now there's 4.
Okay.
And so you're managing these game zones are vast regions that just encompass way different areas. And I say that because it's got to be tough because they're trying to manage these turkeys over areas where some areas they probably shouldn't be shooting any, to be honest. And there's some they could probably shoot way more than they possibly could, and they're still fine. Our properties, we've got way more birds where you would think around the springhead, the spring-fed creeks, the swamps. And, you know, it's interesting, one of our main properties that is, it's about a third of it is in agricultural farm, you know, farmland. And we've got, you know, it's pine country, but we've got turkeys. But it's just, they're very infrequent. The past couple of years, we've had one bird gobbling. So I didn't want to kill them. At least one bird that we heard. We have far more quail. That's the anomaly that just doesn't make sense. We see more quail. We hear more quail throughout the entire year, not just during season. So it's my theory on that is that I think we have wild quail, they will flourish. But wild quail, I think wild quail do better hiding from predators and basically surviving. Turkeys are a lot different. And turkeys, quail, they're on the ground. We have a lot more thickets. So, but that's, you know, we're looking to shoot anywhere from 3 to 4 birds mm-hmm. any given year. And as far as cooking them up, man, I know people like frying them, frying turkey nuggets, and they're good, but I love smoking. I love smoking a turkey breast, brining it. It doesn't take that long, but smoke it for a couple hours. Or I've been doing some teriyaki turkey where I just simply marinate it and do it like hibachi style on Blackstone with some fried rice and veggies.
So what are you doing with the legs? So, I mean, is that something that you're doing the slow cooking and then doing any kind of teriyaki or smoke, or is that inclusion, or is you just talking breast meat there? What's your
with the legs? A lot of times I will slow cook those, like pressure cooker, mm-hmm. try to slow cook them and then just pull them apart. Maybe, you know, as almost like pulled turkey tacos.
Yeah.
I've tried smoking them and I've gone through before and just cut out every like tendon and smoked them, and you get some meat, but it's almost like smoking whitetail ribs.
Yeah.
You know, you get some good meat, but sometimes the juice isn't worth the squeeze. So, you know, I save them. I don't waste them, but I'll try to, you know, pressure cook them, or, you know, put them in a crock pot full of juice, cover them up.
Yeah.
That's what I found. It's like, if you cook them legs, it's almost like putting some venison in a crock pot. It's got to be covered in liquid, or if not, it's just going to dry out.
Yep. 100%. Or a lot of times I've, when I first started doing that in like a slow cooker, I think I pulled it at like the 3 or 4 hour mark, and it was just, nope, it needed like almost twice that amount of time, you know, it's like low and slow for a long time.
That's right.
But I'm really excited about the turkey season coming up. Kind of recapping your last season, what were some of the highlights for you in the field? It could be you, it could be, you know, seeing someone get their first, you know, big game animal or whatever it may be. Just lay us out with some of the things that were kind of memorable and as you're kind of looking back on the season behind us.
Yeah, man. A couple of highlights, I would say we had a family friend of ours. It was their daughter. And I think it was their last kid. I think all of their kids have shot their first deer on our property. Their daughter, 7, shot her first deer. And that deer was like over 100 pounds, about twice as big as she was. You know, we observed some pretty cool things. There was, like I said, we had several fawn does that were harvested in December that got pregnant in early November, which means, and they were 77, 78 pounds. So they were healthy enough in early November to get pregnant, not as opposed to a lot of times they'll hit the first heat cycle in late November. Taking my son hunting. My daughter, she likes going hunting with me, but she likes more eating candy and just, you know, having fun. So we still do that. My son, he is 4, and I've been taking him for 2 years now. And so this year, he really progressed on blood trails. And it just kind of happened organically. He just, you know, he's finding the blood first, and he's trailing it and kind of learning that way. So I didn't know where we were going to go, where I was going to go with my kids and outdoors. But what I think's happening, or what is happening, is that we finish our second season together. He's nowhere near pulling the trigger on a rifle or a gun or mm-hmm. crossbow or whatever. But I think what's happening is that he's learning the ropes. You know, he's learning, you know, how to sit still, because all of our stands are kind of open stands. Yeah, we got cover and wraps around them, but it's not a redneck blind. It's not a make all the noise you want. So he's learning how to be quiet, walking in, walking out, blood trails way before he pulls a trigger, which I think is good.
Yeah.
That was probably one of the highlights for me. I shot a very cool 6-year-old buck. And it's just, I've used a lot of the data that I've been pulling, and it was kind of one of those where it was, you know, hunting mobile in a climber. And it was one of those where everything just kind of worked out, but it all made sense. It all made sense how it did. So yeah, we had a very good season. I think we ended up with, you know, I estimate the meat based on the venison yield.
Mm-hmm.
Averaging of a white-tailed deer. But yeah, we think we ended up with 81. We finished off after youth weekend with 81 or 82 total deer. And we donated well over 1,000 pounds of meat to different organizations and friends and family. So to me, that I think that's probably one of the cooler sides of, you know, land management. Yeah, you know, bucks are cool and this and that, but, you know, taking people hunting. I know you've had Doug Duran on. He just won Deer Manager of the Year, and he's big on that. Absolutely. It's just sharing the land. That's what we do. That's what we've always done. And also the venison, man, because it just, most people, if you ask people, they want venison. They've had it somewhere at a restaurant or whatever, and they want it. But they don't know how to ask for it, and they don't really know. A lot of people, I don't think they understand that in general, especially in the South. I mean, you know, you're in Texas. You see in Texas, too, a lot of land management, you're having to harvest way more deer and venison than you can personally eat yourself.
Sure.
It's got to go somewhere.
Yep.
So, man, just, I mean, it's amazing how many people would thoroughly like good quality venison if you just ask them.
Oh, that's been kind of, I'll go out to the property and I'm like, okay, I know I'm going to try to take two or three doe this weekend. I'm calling friends and like, hey, when I give you the call, start driving this way, you know, or like whatever it is, I'll quarter it up for you. It might be missing one back strap that happened to fall into my cooler over here, but as far as the rest of it, here you go. And that's happened, you know, many times over where we're always trying to share that out with friends who might have been like, oh yeah, I used to have that when I was a kid. And I'm like, here, we'll try this. So what do you have? Well, here's some recipes. I mean, you know, you and I have met enough people that we can have some recipes, at least point some people in some good directions to be like, hey, go check this out. Or, you know, this one might be one if you've got this cut of meat or whatever. And, you know, same kind of thing too. You talk about like sharing the land. There's a lot of folks coming in to our property, the learning and just having fun exploring that. And then putting in some work and some sweat equity, and then they get to enjoy some really fresh venison for them and their family, and then learn about cooking it. And, you know, hopefully some of the shows that, you know, like you or I have done with some of these chefs and cooks can be able to kind of be a resource for them to tap into and learn more and be able to kind of maybe bring that into their own lifestyle or teach their kids as many circumstances have been. And I just find it to be such a rewarding thing. The camaraderie of, you know, and fellowship of your friends and family is just, it's second to none, man. And you know, just kind of think about just sitting around the campfire after some of these experiences and, or under the skinning shed, you know, it's nice to be outside of the weather if it's raining, but, you know, being able to chat and kind of, it's something that it's a part of our heritage and our hunting culture, and especially in the South. And I think that's great that you're a voice of that kind of heritage that we're trying to continue to, you know, pass on to our future generations. So, I definitely tell everyone that, you know, is listening right now to go check out your podcasts and check out your website. Your article's great. I was even reviewing one this morning while I was getting an oil change about, you know, now is a great time in the winter months. And, you know, right now it's the end of January recording this and talking about going through your property and being able to see, you know, the game trails where where stuff's moving through. And that's one of my favorite times. If you want to maybe just touch on that, maybe that article that you wrote too, and what people might be doing as best to, you know, kind of pre-scout or even the post-scout of things in this time of year and why it's an important time to get out there.
Yeah. I appreciate you bringing that up. I know I wrote the article, but I really like that article. I mean, I've put some out there. They're just kind of basic articles, but I thought that one, because that just kind of, that idea kind of came up and it seems basic. And most people say, yeah, Mark, I get it. You know, Wolf the Woods and Scout. But what I was getting at is that, like, that buck I mentioned, that 6-year-old buck, that buck, the reason why I was in that tree on that trail was from walking the woods right now. So what I've been doing the past, I think, 3 seasons now is that I shut the trail cameras off during the season. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'll run them, you know, throughout the off season. And then I'll go pretty heavy kind of late summer, usually around, you know, July, you start to see the antlers, kind of what they're probably going to be. And then try to run them up until sometime in September when pre-rut shifting and the bucks have already kind of, you know, starting to shift where they're going to shift after the velvet peels. And so I say that because, what I found was, when we were going back to, you know, the QDM records and whatnot, when I was running cameras throughout the season, we were not, I mean, statistically, our doe numbers were just plummeting. We weren't shooting them. And the reason I think is because we have these bucks on camera, and it happened to friends and family that they get invited up to hunt with us, or even me and my brother and father. You have these bucks on camera, and you're like, you know what? There's five does out. It's getting late. I could take out one, but I know there's these bucks that are around, and maybe they're just going to pop out. And
any
just,
minute. Yeah.
Right. And so there was one season where our doe numbers got down. I mean, I was shockingly low. I didn't realize where we were. So it wasn't really on purpose, but it's also time management. You know, running cameras, even cell cameras, is time consuming. It also became not fun. And I know people are going to say, well, listen, I love trail cameras just like everybody else. But when you become, or at least I shouldn't say that, when I became obsessed with bucks and I would name them, I gave them really cool wrestler names, you know, the coolest names. And then you don't
well,
kill
let's hear
them.
Some of them.
You know, I reluctantly named, I didn't want to, I saw Ravishing Rick Rude was probably one that, man, he was like, our property was definitely in his core area. I mean, I'm sure it overlapped a little bit, but I got him throughout the summer, the off season, during the rut. I could just never catch up to him. It would drive me crazy. And, you know, at a certain point, people talk about getting burned out by hunts, and it became not fun. Plus, we weren't shooting enough does. So then it's like, okay, if you're not shooting enough does, you have these bucks. And that was the extra layer to where we're having all these bucks on camera. They're on our property, but we're not seeing them. You got a problem. If you're not seeing them, you can't shoot them, which means you've got to restructure some things. So I stopped running cameras, and, you know, I scout right now. I walk the woods right now, and, you know, it's wet, it's rainy, it's cold, moisture's not drying up. You can see these tracks.
Oh, yeah.
And you can see the fresh sign that just happened, the rubs. Some of the scrapes are still active by young bucks that just can't get out of their system. But seeing all this fresh sign, you're seeing the bedding, you're seeing the trails, and you're seeing this very high concentration of buck sign. That's where you need to be. And then you combine that with your doe data. You know when they're getting pregnant. You match that up and you hunt. So that's when I do most of my scouting, is right now going through turkey season. While you're turkey hunting, you see the stuff. One of the cool thing I probably will mention this past year was I rattled in a buck October 13th. It's Friday the 13th in October. And I was rattling. I've been experimenting with rattling since I was in high school. And for a decade or so, it just never worked. Then you start to kind of learn more about it. Because most of the content I was watching was from Texas. And that's where, I mean, you know, that's where I'm preaching the choir here, but that's where QDM started in Texas, you know, with Al Brothers. And so a lot of that rattling came from Texas. Well, that's the birthplace of QDM. And so they know their stuff, and rattling works when you have a good buck doe ratio. Anyways, I'll tell you some very quickly. I know we got to start to go, but I did some of my best scouting unintentionally early October. I was going in to climb in one area. It was alongside of a creek. I was going to hunt this area, some fresh acorns. And I got there, and the thermals were all screwy. You know, early season, before it gets really cold, the wind just shifts every which way. It's warm. There's thermals. I got in the spot, and my scent was just screwing up. Go to the second spot. Third spot, fourth spot, and I finally just kind of gave up. What happened was I was doing a lot of walking on my property at a time when I don't normally walk, you know, and what I was seeing, I was bumping all these deer on foot, trying to find a good place to hunt my climber. And I ended up not finding a good spot, but I saw all these deer. I saw a ton of does that were filtering off my neighbor's property. And, you know, then I got on my aerial map and kind of realized, well, Mark, this should be a no-brainer. Look at this. I had that conversation with you. Look at your aerial map. They're coming from your neighbor's property on a thicket, and it's an intersection of paved roads. They're probably not crossing paved roads. They're going on your property. It seemed obvious, but it wasn't until you visualized it.
Yeah.
And then before, right around dark, still walking around, and I was on this Firebright trail against a swamp, right going, you know, uphill. And right when I was trying to figure, right when I realized I was looking at a deer, it turned, looked at me. I could tell it had antlers, and it was too late to try to throw up and shoot. It was too far away, and I ran uphill, walked over there. He was working a scrape, looked like a nice buck, and I waited 2 weeks, went back and rattled him in. And so I already knew where he was and frequented, but then why would rattling work? Because it was right on the cusp, right a week, about a week, 10 days before our does were going to heat. Mm-hmm. And that's when you hear people, you know, you hear the biologists talk about, that's when rattling works through the actual research. So that was pretty cool to, and I went back where I was talking about seeing the does. I went back and shot three over the rest of the season, individual hunts. It's just, that's something I would never have planned to do. But I tell you, just walking the woods, bumping all those deer, I learned what they were doing. And I a lot of people wouldn't want to do that. But I don't know, I might do it again. You know, just wait some time and go back in. Because, you know, deer, they're not going to leave your property.
Right.
You're going to educate them, but they're going to kind of stay where they are. But they just move around us.
Yeah. No, that was exemplified. And I was listening to your podcast. You're talking about how all the rifle shots, like in our property, we're always hearing people. There's, you know, some weekend warriors that are rocking it out and they're just doing plinking and stuff. They got their ARs out there and they're just, you know, having a good time shooting target practice, but it's constant. Like, and especially during the hunt season, there's just people that are out there just practicing and you're hearing it and the deer kind of look up. And I mean, it's, you know, a lot of people think, oh, you know, you can sneeze and everything within 40 acres is going to run out and you'll never see him again. But you know, you might bump a deer, but that doesn't mean they're not going to come back through that. If that's their area, if that's where they're bedding down, like I really suggest that people go out and explore the properties. And I think this is a great time of year. And like what you were saying too. And I think a point I was going to make is like when you were saying about the trails and seeing where they're going through, doing those walks now may be able to tell you where to put your game trail cameras so that you can maybe get the most out of that data and information. And I also like your idea too, of shutting it down. I've kept my game trails on one property year round. And then, usually I'm focusing on one cause there's a lot of people that are coming in and hunting that spot. And so I want to educate them. Hey, this is a deer that is this old, you know, this rack may look huge, but this is at this age class, we're letting this deer walk. You know, this is not on the hit list or this is how many doe, this is the size of the doe we're looking at, using it as an educational tool, right? For that. But there was another property that while I'm looking at this one, I'm not looking at that other one. And I found it to be really fun to kind of go in it slightly blind. I mean, we'd still look up and just kind of see what's there, just to kind of see what's on camera because we have it out there running. But I think going into something blind too, and just whatever comes in front of you and what you're going to see, instead of going and like people are, I had a lot of folks who were like all, they've been buck focused. They're like, I saw this one deer, I want to go after that deer. And hey, yeah, there was six healthy doe that came through that could fill your freezer just the same. You just passed on them because that big buck, any minute he's coming out, you know, every
That's
night.
Right.
And so then what sometimes happens is you have people who go home with no meat in the freezer, or they've passed up an experience for another one that didn't ever show. So I think it's, those are all very valuable points to talk about. And I think I like how you kind of mentioned that too. Sometimes it's good to shut them off, you know, it's get your data points, but then, you know, at the same point, you know, go out in the woods and just enjoy and see what comes out and, you know, just keep your eyes peeled and your coffee fresh to keep you awake.
That's right. Or, you know, at least put them on like passive trail camera sites, you know, where like trails, you know, legit trails to where you're keeping tabs on them on your property, but it's like, not that destination, you know, acorn crop or you know, food plots. Because I, you know, something else would happen is you got a big buck in the area, but then another buck comes out, and you've got a guest there, a friend, and you know, I'm sure you host, you have people to hunt with you, and so do I. And you know, if you're in the woods a lot, at a certain point, after hunting a certain period of time, you become well-versed and, you know, being the judge deer, you know, well, I mean, that's, you know, it, But some people can't. I couldn't do that at one point in my life. So I'm not knocking. Some at certain hunter stage, you can't do that. So if they know there's this big, you know, big giant bucks out there, and then a nice little 2-year-old comes out, they might just blast away and not really know. So it's just, you know, whatever someone wants to hunt, you know, however they, you know, some people want to, you know, pursue one buck. And I mean, I got to tell you, like, I respect those dudes and the guys that do it and kill them. Cause that's pretty hard. It's, you know, it's whatever someone wants to do as long as it's legal. Right.
Indeed. Right. And, I kind of think about that with like Mark Kenyon and even the Element Boys and talking about their focus on one particular deer. And sometimes, you know, Mark Kenyon had an article, I guess it was about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago, where he was talking about how he got burnt out by, you know, I think the idea when you're at that level of content creation and stuff too, but it can be difficult. But he talked about how he wanted to just kind of rewind. And I spoke with him about how that was for him when he took a different approach to it. And so, you know, it's never too late to change. If there's something that you kind of getting burnt out, you know, take a different approach. If you've been doing cameras and you're so enamored with checking the camera all the time, maybe it's a season or, you know, a month to take it off and just see how it is. And, you know, you never know, but I think, those are all valid points. And, you know, I'm excited for, to follow, you know, you picking up with the Southern Way and seeing, you know, the guests you have on and things you have to share. You've been, you know, a great resource, for many people, you know, not just in your region, to learn more about deer and quality deer management and, habitat improvements and things too. So I appreciate what you're bringing to the table there and all you're sharing. I kind of had a question that, you know, probably relates to that as well, is your idea of like your own personal legacy in a professional setting and what you're doing and what you're sharing and personal, like, how is it that you hope to be making an impact and that you'll be remembered for what you're doing now, in both of those avenues?
Well, that's a deep question, George.
No pressure.
That's a good question. I would just say that, I guess it's, I never really thought about this as far as a legacy, but I would like to think that I may have made an impact on conservation efforts in the South. And that was another reason why I started Southeast Whitetail. I know earlier I mentioned hunting content, but the focal points of Southeast Whitetail are habitat, conservation, and venison. And, you know, habitat, better than habitat, because it can get lost in the shuffle, because I've talked about we have too many deer, and people see deer in Walmart parking lots, and there's deer in most suburban developments in the Southeast. Whether you're coastal or you're inland, there are deer in that development that are probably having to be regulated in some eventually. So it can get lost in shuffle. We have so many deer, Mark. There's a problem. And it's like, well, but they're not, a lot of those herds aren't healthy. Right. And we have, and take for instance, I mean, if you drive down an interstate in the South, you know, most places too, but high density areas, you drive on interstate during breeding season, there's deer everywhere. And, you know, you talk about quail and turkey. Those are detrimental to, you know, land fragmentation. That's what I'm talking about. And conservation, all that goes together. I think there's a lot going on. And the other part of legacy, I would like to have made an impact on quality deer management, you know, QDM. Joe Hamilton, I did a sit down interview with him, video on YouTube. Joe Hamilton was a mentor of mine. He just didn't know it for so many years. And I looked up to him and got to know him. But, you know, with him essentially bringing the QDM movement from your neck of the woods in Texas via Al Brothers to the South and, you know, pushing that, because I don't think we would have seen the boom in a more part of the country than we did. Like, you know, y'all were doing it in Texas. I mean, y'all were managing deer like cattle, and that's essentially where it was started. But having that boom of these big bucks and everything, but now we can't we can't let our foot off the gas, meaning we can't stop regulating does just because we got some good bucks and we're now shooting, a lot of states are shooting more does than bucks annually. We can't stop. Just like what I'm saying, I mean, we're barely breaking even, and we're not, you know, because the fawn recruitment and everything else like that. So I would like to, you know, QDM is something, in my opinion, is never going to go away as long as you have deer in the landscape. As long as you have deer in the landscape, and with our ever expanding human footprint, you know, we need to help habitat and conservation.
100%, man. I'm right there with you and all that, and definitely agree. For people who are ready to follow your journey, learn more about you, tune into your podcast, why don't you give them all that information real quick and where they can, you know, find you and follow you?
Sure, absolutely. I'm primarily active on Instagram. My personal is at Mark Haslam, and it's at southeast.whitetail, southeastwhitetail.com. And podcast Southeast Whitetail and the Southern Way. Please reach out to me. I mean, if anyone would like to be on the podcast or have any ideas for me, I tell you, it's, you know, what I'm doing, it's a labor of love. It's a passion, George, but it's the biggest kick I get, because it's, you know, you can make some money here, you can make some money there, but ultimately it's not going to replace or at least what I'm doing, it's never going to replace, you know, my full-time gig. I am doing some consulting work on the side, which, you know, helps fill in with my real estate. But it's just what I love is just when I interact with someone, whether I see a guy on the street that I've known and he mentions something he's seen of, you know, an article or a podcast, or someone sends me a message. It's just cool, you know, that someone's, you know, people are consuming the content and they appreciate it and they're acknowledging it.
I think that's a huge thing, man. I mean, it feels like your time is well spent, worthwhile. And it's not just you're sharing. It's not just in coming in one way. Because I know when I'm talking to you, I'm learning things. I'm talking to a lot of the other guests. I'm learning things that I can put out. But I'm trying to make sure that I'm being a conduit for that information for other people to be able to get out there or learn a little bit more, maybe get more invested in their local areas and their chapters or QDM or whatever it may be, to, you know, conservation agencies, trying to make sure that we all collectively keep this way of life, you know, striving and surviving for our future generations. That's kind of, that's one of my goals. And I think I think we're, you know, two peas in that pod of just trying to make sure we're doing that part, and we get to meet some cool people like yourself along the way. So likewise. I'm really glad you joined me. Thank you. I'm glad you joined me today. I'm looking forward to coming on your podcast as well. And everyone go follow all those sites, podcasts. I'll have all the links below for you to check them out. So please go and look at those, follow, give him those 5-star reviews that he has earned so diligently with your wonderful work, everything you're sharing. Mark, been a joy today, and I look forward to hopefully doing this in person sometime.
That's right. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on. This has been a blast, and I look forward to having you on my podcast. I want some good Texas talk.
Oh,
when I get you on,
I'm ready. I've got some things for you, man, for sure, man. We've had quite an interesting season and last few seasons, so I've definitely
good.
I got some content for you.
Okay.
Cool, man. You take care.
You too. Thanks.
Bye bye.